You are listening to Arrive by The Cycling Podcast, supported by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Wow, well, Lizzie, here we are again for another Arrive for Liège-Bastogne-Liège this time. And how different that was from the last time we did an Arrive, Tour of Flanders, where there was like one moment in the whole race that decided the whole thing. To come and watch Liège-Bastogne-Liège, there'd be so much going on, and see Demi Vollering crowned the triple Ardennes champion, having won Amstel at the beginning of the race, then Flèche in the middle of the week, and then to finish it off with Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I have to ask you, Lizzie, on the waffleometer, how many waffles does that race get? Tell me.
10 out of 10 Liège waffles, that was. I mean, I was trying to write the moments of the monument, and it was a very short one for Ronde van Vlaanderen, and this was more like the trilogy of the monument. There was so much that happened today. So absolutely fantastic race today. If you haven't seen it, please do go and watch it, but we're going to summarise everything for you and pick out the best bits. But that is pretty difficult because the whole thing was really thrilling, plots changing, everything twisting, and the race getting turned on its head again and again. Very good race today.
It was crazy, was it? Very good race, very good breakfast for you, was it? How many waffles did your waffleometer go to for your breakfast? That's the big question.
Unfortunately, my waffleometer breakfast was only a 2 out of 10, but I had Liège waffles for breakfast this morning, made by my husband and my brother-in-law. Absolutely delicious. I would say they got a 10 out of 10 for performance of the waffles, but only a 2 out of 10 in terms of numerical, you know, the number of waffles that I had on my plate, number two. So it was
well, that gives them... They've got room to progress. I mean, if you'd actually eaten 10 waffles, I think your return to racing might be a little delayed, mightn't it?
Well, you did suggest that I should smother my waffles in chocolate, and I went for the healthy option of strawberries, but very, very good waffles this morning for my breakfast.
Well, the Liège-Bastogne-Liège was the chocolate on the top of the waffle today, wasn't it? It was really exciting. So let's find out a bit about... what happened, and it's called Moment of the Monument, isn't it? But moments, many moments of the monument that you're going to take us through, Lizzie. Roll off.
Well, Rose, with the final race in the Ardennes upon us and Demi Vollering's glass already half full with optimism, the question on
half
everybody's
full,
lips.
Everyone. Don't want anyone to miss that Demi pun.
I was trying to be subtle. The question on everybody's lips was, would she be able to take the triple crown? 135 riders started the 143 kilometres of unrelentingly hilly terrain between Bastogne and Liège. A new addition for this year's race was the climb of the Côte de Stocou, 1 kilometre at 13%. At 81 kilometres to go, it was poised to add some early spice, and that it did with a powerful break forging clear. Marlon Reusser of SD Works, Canyon Tram Racing's Cassia Nibiodoma, Amanda Spratt for Trek Segafredo, Anna Henderson of Jumbo-Visma, and Esme Pepperkamp of DSM broke clear and quickly gained a 1 minute advantage. Movistar and FDJ Sewers were forced to chase behind, with Marta Cavalli providing much of the horsepower. 50 kilometres to go, an untimely rear puncture for Canyon Shram's Nibiodoma saw her slip from the brake to the peloton after taking a wheel from neutral service. Canyon Shram quickly reacting to start pulling to close the gap to the brake, which was now sitting at 25 seconds. The quartet hit the Côte de la Redoute, where Reusser rocked steady on the 16% slopes, upped the pace and turned the screw on her former companions, pushing out the gap to the peloton and leaving Spratt and Pepperkamp dangling between. In the peloton behind, world champion Van Vleuten forced the pace as the cream of the climbers now rose to the top of the La Redoute. As the size of the peloton ebbed and flowed with the fall and the rise of the roads, the lack of cohesion saw Reusser's gap go out to 1:35. Spratt, still stuck firmly in the gap between, meant Trek Segafredo was sitting pretty with numbers in the peloton behind. 23 kilometres to go, and Lippert took action and launched an attack so hard that she promptly dropped herself. But with teammate Van Vleuten making the cut and driving the pace, the gap began to tumble as Spratt came in sight and was quickly reabsorbed. Onto the fast descent, and the group swelled once again as Trek Segafredo took the race by the horns, and on the run into the decisive Côte de la Rochefoucauld, Spratt and Van Anroy with Longo Borghini on their wheels set an infernal pace, gapping all but Elise Chabé and depositing Longo Borghini into the pace of the climb with a gap on the peloton and, crucially, Demi Vollering. The gap to Reusser had now tumbled to 30 seconds at the base of the climb. Longo Borghini further shattered the gap to 20 seconds halfway up, with the remains of the peloton in tatters behind. Shabby was glued to the wheel of Longo Borghini, whilst following emerged from the pack and steadily closed to the gap to the chasing duo. Over the top now, and Roycer seemingly caught, she went once again, with Longo Borghini making it across and no reaction behind. Van Vleuten, Shabby, Raiolini and Marcus now behind, with Vollering timing her jump to perfection to make it across to the leading pair of Roycer and Longo Borghini. The SD Works riders traded places as Vollering went straight to the front to drive the pace, and Roycer could no longer hold the pace. Behind, with Van Vleuten still doing the lion's share of the work, the gap went out and was at 27 seconds with 1.7 kilometres to go. A cagey two-up sprint saw Vollering force Longo Borghini to the front, and she launched her sprint for a hard-fought demolition to take the win in Liège-Bastogne-Liège and the prestigious Triple Crown. The second female rider to do so after her coach and sports director Van der Breggen did it in 2017. Van Vleuten opened the sprint behind, but with Shabby and Marcus fanning across the road, it was Roycer who came from behind to take the third spot on the podium.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Well, 10 out of 10 on the waffleometer for your fantastic puns there, Lizzie. I could not even keep up. Like Cavalli horsepower. I don't know. Demolition.
I have to say that wasn't actually mine. That was my brother-in-law, so I have to give credit to. I can't even take the credit for the pun there. But it was a remarkable demolition that she performed this week, wasn't it? And I think much of it was definitely down to Marlen Roycer, both in this race and in, well, particularly in Flèche Wallonne, actually, on Wednesday.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because I think we were making a lot earlier in the season about Demi Vollering and Lotte Kopecky and how both of those riders being at SD Works, how they could play together and basically, you know, go for the wins throughout the season. But actually, it is more that Marlen Roycer and Demi Vollering as a duo, that's the key to the success. It's definitely the key to Demi Vollering's success. I mean, I was having a little look at, you know, which races they were in, and Marlen Roycer was in all of the Belgian classics that Vollering had done, except Amstel. Although that's not Belgian, so I've kind of carefully sidestepped that little pitfall there.
Very clever, very clever.
And of course, then Marlen Roycer also got a win for herself at Gent-Wevelgem on top of that. So, I mean, I guess, Lizzie, what is it that makes Marlen Roycer so key to Demi Vollering's success? Because there is kind of a Venn diagram there where they both have this ability to put out a sustained amount of power, don't they? But then, you know, Roycer is more of a time trialist, although Vollering can time trial, as we saw in the women's tour, didn't we, a few years back. And of course, Demi Vollering is better on a longer climb. But, you know, what is it that makes those two such a powerful duo?
Well, it's partly just about numbers, isn't it? I think the thing is that, you know, especially with these races in the Ardennes, you often think about, well, you know, the sort of the pure climbers. But a rider like Marlen Roycer has such a high power that we saw her performance on the Côte de la Redoute. She just simply dropped everybody else, including Amanda Spratt, who is one of the best climbers in the world. And having a rider like that who can force breaks, who can bring things back, who is always there. I mean, we saw that, you know, she was still able to sprint to third in the end of the race after having been out for 80 kilometres, really, and solo for about 30 kilometres. You know, she was still able to sprint to third despite being gasping for water. We also saw her about 8 kilometres to go to neutral service and say, please, can I have some water? And, you know, not realising, of course, she was within the 20 kilometres where you can't take it without a penalty. And she is so strong that they've always got another option. So if she's up the road, Demi Vollering doesn't have to move one bit. She just has to follow. She doesn't have to do any extra work. Whereas Canyon SRAM, Trek Segafredo were all having to put in a lot of effort with various riders, all having to do attacks. All Demi Vollering had to do is follow. And, you know, of course, she still had to make that move on the Côte de la Rochefoucauld to get over to Longo Borghini and Roycer and Shabby. but she wasn't having to expend any energy otherwise. And so if you're in the position where you not only have numbers, but those numbers are incredibly strong, then that's how you become unbeatable. And that's always been SD Works' key to success. Numbers who can win the race. You know, I have to say, I really thought Royce had this tied up. I thought...
So did I.
Yeah, I nearly texted you saying like, oh, sigh, Marlon's going to win the race.
I'm so glad
I didn't. I mean, Marlon Royce is great. I love her. I respect her. She's a friend as well as a colleague. But I kind of thought like, oh, that's it, race over. And from a viewer perspective, wanting entertainment, I thought, oh, that's it. I thought there'll be a lack of cohesion in this group behind, and she's just got it tied up because she's like a train, basically.
When I was looking at her win, she's right. I mean, she was today like almost like a swimmer, wasn't she? She has these kind of like broad shoulders, but she kind of cuts through the air. I mean, she kind of glides through, and she doesn't look like, I mean, she did, like you mentioned, Lizzie, I did think, as much as I thought that she was going to win, especially when she had kind of 1:40, was it? And it seemed that she made up kind of 25 seconds on La Redoute on its own. And that was including the fact that the peloton behind were coming in on a descent running onto the climb. So they would have been, you know, catching her up very quickly at that point.
It's one of the hardest parts of the race in the peloton. There's a lead out into that climb. And the peloton is going so fast, and they only had four riders coming in. So the speed differential between the peloton and her would have been much higher.
And so even having that, and for her to be extending her lead, and she was just riding people. It's not like she, you know, she was doing sudden acceleration. She just rode Amanda
First
Spratt
Henderson,
off her
then
wheel.
Pepper Camp, yeah. then Spratt, all of them one by one. They just dropped like flies. And, you know, it was 45 seconds she put into Spratt over the Côte de la Redoute. It was incredibly impressive. And I saw that and I just thought, you know, how are they going to bring her back? And even if they do, well, Vollering will be there and she would attack over the top. So it really seemed like Royza had it tied up, but actually it ended up really very different.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. We should talk about that move from Vollering, because we had Marlon Royce was out ahead, she kind of got brought back, and then she went again with Elisa Longo Borghini, and then Vollering jumped across. Do you think there was a bit of a team discussion there? I mean, obviously we saw Royce as she was kind of going to neutral service a few times, putting her hand up a few times. As much as she looked so comfortable and in control, there was obviously, she felt like she hadn't fueled enough or needed water. Do you think that Marlon Royce had said to the team, I don't think I've got this, when she was with Longo Borghini, and that's why Vollering jumped across at that point? Because obviously normally you wouldn't have a teammate jumping across, you know, when their teammate is ahead like that.
Well, so there's a few things there. So she'd called up neutral service and must have been maybe 25 kilometers to go, maybe before, and she wanted her team car, because neutral service, they have bottles and things, but they don't have the team bottles. So she got her team car to come up at a point where they can pass the peloton and they can still get to her. She could get her team bottles with her team specific carbohydrate drink, her team gels. Obviously, we don't know what was said at that point, but I think actually the real reason wasn't really Royce's fading, but it was the reaction from the bunch behind. It was Lippert who really kicked things off, because the reason I thought she was going to stay away was because over the Côte de la Redoute, Van Vleuten had driven the bunch, Van Vleuten and Shabby actually, and it had really come down to sort of six riders. And I thought, well, at this point, there's basically one from each team and there's not going to be any cohesion. But as the road sort of went downhill and back up again, the group swelled to the point where Canyon, Trek, a number of teams had a number of riders, and there was a bit of cohesion and there were attacks. And then as they hit the next climbs, the pace really went up, and it was when Lippert sort of started the attacks and then Van Vleuten continued that on. That's when things started to drop. And once Trek Segafredo took over, then the pace really dropped. So I think that at that point, it began to be inevitable that she would get caught. And so she basically her job at that point was to basically get as far up the climb of the Côte de la Rochefoucauld as she possibly could, so that if Demi Vollering could get over to her, she could help her for as long as possible before dropping off. And I guess ideally Demi would go solo to the line. But what actually happened was we ended up with a duo of Reuser and Longo Borghini ahead. Vollering was able to bridge a small gap. Marlon Reuser then drove that for a few seconds, basically, which was all she could, before Vollering went through to the front and then drove those two to the finish. So in the end, it worked out as tactically, as perfectly as it could for them. It was the perfect point of the climb. You know, you see on the TV that it says that the Côte de la Rochefoucauld has sort of, you've reached the top of the climb, but it's not the top of the climb at all. There's a very little dip, and then it continues to drag up, and then it gets steeper and steeper. It's sort of like a concrete road which saps all of the energy from you, and there are so often attacks at that point because you've gone up this really steep climb, you've used everything that you can, you're 130 kilometers deep into the race. It's often a crosswind across there as well, although I think today it was a tailwind, and that is the moment that if anybody's got anything left, you have to go. You know, when everybody is on the limit and when you think you can't go anymore, that's the moment that you have to attack, because everybody else thinks that as well. And that's what Vollering did, and she got across to Reuser and Longo Borghini, and Shabby Van Vleuten, Raelini behind, couldn't do anything.
And we should give a few more words, obviously, to the winner, to Demi Vollering. We're going to talk about a little bit later about, you know, what the other teams could have done, or, you know, how else they could have approached it. But it is one of those things that if you'd seen the result on paper and it said Demi Vollering won, then you'd be like, oh, well, that was just totally inevitable, wasn't it? But mm-hmm. it didn't feel like in the race that, like, it didn't feel like that in the race, did it? But, I mean, Demi Vollering has been on such phenomenal form. I mean, of the 8 starts that she's made to races, she's got now 5 victories, 2 second places, one of those being second place to Lotte Kopecky, her teammate, in the Ronde van Vlaanderen. And the other one was a 17th in Omloop. But again, that's, you know, she was in a large group behind Lotte Kopecky again,
her teammate.
So, I mean, her results this season have been incredible. And, you know, coming in with all of that pressure today, because she had a huge amount of pressure, everyone was not looking just at SD Works to win, but they were looking at Vollering to win, weren't they, really?
Yeah, they were. But I also, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I almost wrote in the moments of the monument Demi Vollering's inevitable win, but it really wasn't inevitable at all if you watched what happened in the race. And I also think what's interesting, looking back at her series of, well, there's no other word for it than phenomenal results, outstanding results, is that the dynamic in the race has really, in the races have really changed a lot, because, you know, there was a point, you know, SD Works have won a lot this season. They've won a lot more than anybody else. And there was a point where we kind of thought, well, at Ronde van Vlaanderen, we were saying, you know, who else is going to win? Is anybody going to take it to SD Works? Why aren't the peloton reacting? Perhaps Canyon Schramm have chosen the wrong leader, all of these things. Well, clearly what we learned is that the peloton have been listening to us, Rose, because
yes.
After that, they really seemed to rise to the occasion. And perhaps it was the nature of the races. You know, we had races like Brabant-Sepaille, and then, of course, we came into the Ardennes. And all of these, it suddenly became much more attacking. Roubaix, of course, as well. And I don't know if directors and riders woke up to the fact that they needed to do something about it, or whether it was just the nature of the terrain and the types of races. But the wins have got harder, I feel. I think the wins that SD Works had at the beginning of the season were sort of like easier wins, not expected particularly, maybe. But it's got harder, and the races have got much more unpredictable. And yes, Demi Vollering and SD Works are still winning, and Demi Vollering has obviously won the last 3 World Tour races, but it hasn't been inevitable, and the gap is closing. And I think that is what's really interesting. So they do have this incredibly strong team, which allows them, and, you know, of course, one killer rider. But that gap is closing, and that's what gives me a lot of interest, you know, for the races coming up. And of course, you know, just for the race that we just watched as well, it was a demolition, but it was a very, very good one, a very interesting one, an exciting one.
Well, we actually haven't given too much lip service to Elisa Longo Borghini, who came second. And I feel like, you know, I would have said that she has had a really kind of quiet spring so far. But actually looking at it, a third in Tour of Flanders and a second in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I mean, obviously she's a great champion and would be expecting wins. But actually that's not too bad. But, you know, Lizzie, we were kind of both watching it. I felt like when Vollering and Longo Borghini were off on their own at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, that it was a done deal that Vollering was certain to win. But you kind of thought differently, didn't you?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, so once Vollering had come over to Longo Borghini and Reuser then got dropped and went back to the small group behind. In the beginning, Longo Borghini wasn't coming through. And I thought, yeah, absolutely, doing the right thing. Why would you come through? Vollering wants to win this. She's got a teammate behind who's tired, who at that point may not have even made it over the climb with that group. She's doing absolutely the right thing. Clearly, once the gap for Longo Borghini and Vollering had grown a little bit, she felt a little bit more secure that she should be working. But I felt quite strongly that she shouldn't be working. Of course, there was a risk that the group would come back and somebody would attack her. She had Raiolini in the group behind, and could Raiolini have launched an attack? Obviously, she's a phenomenal climber, but can she do something like that on a flat or a downhill? I don't want to say no, because we haven't seen it yet, but I wouldn't put my money on it, let's say.
I mean, she's very much a climber, but she does have great... and I always think that you never see her all race, and then right at the end, she seems to have this fantastic amount of energy. She really paces her
efforts. She's got good tactical nous
so well.
As well, hasn't she?
Yeah,
really good.
She really does.
Nous. She knows where to be and when to be there, and that is really, really important. And exactly when to make the move, like a Swiss clock. And so that is important, but I don't think that. She wasn't the right rider to launch a sort of a Grace Brown or Lizzie Deignan attack on the downhill, you know?
That's true. Yeah.
But having said that, kind of what did Longo Borghini have to lose? I mean, of course she had the second place to lose, but I think that Demi Vollering had so much more to lose that it was unlikely that Vollering wouldn't have kept working. You know, when Longo Borghini didn't come through, Vollering didn't kind of say, well, I'm not going to work if you're not going to work. She still was working on the front. And once you get to the top of that climb, you go down a little straight road, you go through the university, and then there's a long downhill into Liège, and it's very fast. And if you're on the wheel, you're doing absolutely nothing. And it seems to me like Longo Borghini was actually doing more work on the front than Vollering. And I texted you with 7.5 or 7K to go saying, like, what is she doing? Why is she working? And you completely agreed. And she wasn't able to, you know, the only other thing is if she could have forced Vollering into the first position in the sprint, which she wasn't able to, you know, Vollering really forced her so that she was on the barriers, on the front. And actually, when Longo Borghini launched her sprint with 200 meters to go, they you know, Vollering didn't even come behind from behind. It was just a two-up drag sprint, and Vollering had more power. I do think that Longo Borghini has got better in the sprints, but Vollering's got such a strong kick that...
Well, we saw it, didn't we, at the women's tour.
Yeah.
We were like, but that was a surprise when she came to sprint to take the overall... was that last year? God, the years go so slowly.
That was the end of... Longo Borghini came through to take that bonus second on the line. Yeah,
but that was a real surprise, her sprint there.
And a lot of that was due to positioning as well. Her Trek Segafredo team had done such a good job of positioning her in the run into a technical finale, and this was really a very straight sprint, mano a mano. And it seemed like it was a foregone conclusion, really, once they came into the finish line together.
It wasn't really cat and mouse, was it? It was like mouse and mouse until, as you said, Lizzie, like literally about 150 metres to go before they kicked it off there. But we had seen, I mean, the only real time actually this season where we've seen Demi Vollering be beaten was by Sylvia Persico in Brabant Shapil. And in that, Sylvia Persico waited for Demi Vollering to open up her sprint and then came round to her right at the last moment. And I felt that Lisa Longo Borghini was trying to get Vollering to go, but they were just, you know, playing chicken for far too long. And then she felt that she needed to go and, you know, But I guess at that point, you've got no choice, do you? I mean, you can't literally make it a 10-metre sprint, or can you? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that's
would she have won a 10-metre sprint?
Actually,
even?
That is a good question, because for the in the very first part of the sprint, in the initiation, you know, Longo Borghini was still ahead. So, yeah, do you wait and then just do a really short one? But maybe she felt that if Vollering went first, then you know she wasn't gonna win. If Vollering had gone first from the front, perhaps she'd have had a chance. But if they go from side by side, or if Longo Borghini goes from the front, I think that yeah, it's very 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 unlikely. And you know, throwing back to Silvia Persico at Brabant Sepyl, that's a rider who we know has a very very good kick. Mm. You know, on the flat,
cyclocross rider. Yeah,
yeah. You know, that's a rider who, you know, if you put them side by side on you know top trumps cards, you wouldn't be sure who would win. But you know, we know from prior experience that yeah, Dummy Vollering does have the edge on Longo Borghini. So I felt that really she should have been sitting on more. She said in her post race interview that. Well, she said first that she was a little bit disappointed in the finish, but then she said that she was actually very pleased with the execution of the team overall. They executed it exactly as they'd planned with their DS Ina Teutenberg. They put Amanda Spratt in the early break. And they really, I think the thing that they executed incredibly well was this team performance where they shattered the race at about 17 kilometres to go. They went on the front and they absolutely drilled it. And they delivered Elisa Longo Borghini into the base of this critical climb with a gap on Demi Vollering, so the pressure was on the opponent there in order to close that gap. And I think that was, you know, that was really some tactical masterpiece and masterclass, and tactical, you know, sorry, and a masterclass of teamwork as well. It was really a full team job. So yeah, I don't know, I guess the odds were against her in the final, and you know, they were kind of betting on getting the second place with a chance of getting the first, rather than if you don't work, then there's a chance of getting absolutely nothing. So it's a hard one, but I was surprised that she was working.
But I mean, it was an amazing performance like you touched on there, Lizzie, from Trek, wasn't it? I mean, it was very different to the kind of approach that we've seen the rest of the season. And it was interesting to me seeing all of the Trek riders at the front there. I mean, we had Shirin Van Anroy, Raelini, we had Longo Borghini, we had of course Amanda Spratt continuing to do work even after she'd been caught by the she was in the break, and even after she was caught she was doing work to kind of reel Marlon Reusser back in. It was a great team performance from that perspective, and it was interesting because I saw them getting a little bit frustrated that other teams weren't coming in with them to try and help that effort. There was a lot of kind of arms flinging, looking around, looking behind them, wondering where everyone else was. But it is kind of on a team like Trek. You know, when SD Works have the race under control, it's only up to Trek Segafredo, isn't it, from looking at the other teams to, you know, step up to the plate and make the work there?
Yeah, Trek Segafredo definitely had the strongest team. And you know, of course, their previous best team in the world. A lot of teams will look to them. Canyon Shram, I would say, are the other team that could have taken it up. And I can't just say could have taken it up, because they did take it up. I think they were very unfortunate. They'd put Nevia Doma had gone in the break, whether they'd put her there or whether she'd gone in the break, because of course this new climb of the Côte de Stocku, it was 1 kilometre at 13%. So whatever break had gone on that climb has got to be a very strong break, a break that can, you know, it's going to be a break that can survive the climbs, because of course it's been forged on one of the hardest climbs. And so they were in an excellent position. They had Shabby behind, they had Ricarda Bauernfeind, who actually has, you know, I think we'll talk more about her in the monthly podcast. She's been having a phenomenal season, an amazing ride at Flèche Wallonne actually. And, you know, Shabby's been looking really, really good. She's been there, but not quite able to finish it off. And maybe this was going to be her day. And it was a really badly timed puncture for Nevia Doma that saw her come out of that front group. And they did have numbers coming into the Côte de la Rochefoucauld. They had Paladin, they had Nevia Doma, Bauernfeind, and Shabby. But they weren't pulling in the same way that Trek Segafredo was. So I can understand the frustration there. But they had done a lot of attacking. They had done, I think they'd done their part in the race, and I think they were saying, well, it's somebody else's job. So I do understand that. And in the end, you know, they ended up profiting off this move that Trek Segafredo did, because Elise Chabé was the only other rider to get ahead with Longo Borghini into the base of the Rochefoucauld. Jumbo Visma, potentially they could have done some more work, because they did have numbers there and they were working for Rianna Marcus. They could have sent more riders to the front. There were points where they sent a rider to the front, but it didn't really sort of, you know, the chase didn't last very long. But, you know, really the reality of it is, if you've got a rider like Reusser ahead, you've got to have a blimmin' strong rider chasing behind, and a number of strong riders chasing behind and pulling off, in order to actually make any inroads. Otherwise, it's, you know, the European time trial champion versus anybody else, and you're not going to close that gap. So, yeah.
Let's hear from one of those strong riders that did actually, you know, make it right to the finish. And you got a voice note from her, didn't you, Lizzie, after the race? That's Elise Chabé.
Hey, Lizzie, I hope it's not too late. Just see your message now. Yeah, I mean, it's such a shame for Kasia, because, in this break, she was really in a good position. And, yeah, then she had this puncture, and, yeah, then we had to put some riders to chase. I had some really good legs, so, yeah, I was feeling good also on La Redoute. And then I was like, okay, I need to keep fighting in La Roche, because I think I can be among the best. And in La Roche, it's just such a shame, because Demi opened the gap on Elisa in the kind of downhill, and the gap was there, and then Demi just attacked and jumped, and yeah, it was hard to follow her, and yeah, I stick to Annemiek, and yeah, we were close but not close enough, so a bit frustrating. And also this sprint for the third place, I'm really disappointed I missed that, but I asked Marlen to lead out for me, but she didn't want to, so yeah, sad. Next time I think we need to keep fighting with the team. We have a really strong team at the moment, and I think we really deserve it, so yeah, let's keep fighting.
Well, that was quite disappointed Elise Chabé, as you can hear. And she, you know, she finished just off the podium again in fifth after a fourth place in Brabantsepile after a very attacking race. A disappointed Elise Chabé, but not a disappointing one. A very good race from her, but just missing it right at the end, which will be gutting after a top 10 in Flèche Wallonne as well, actually.
But it is great also to see Canyon SRAM putting a bit more faith in her, perhaps, you know, moving their tactics around a little bit, because it used to be kind of it's Cash and Evidoma or bust, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And now it's quite clear, like, that they are using Chabé as another option to get the win, actually. And actually, probably a more viable option now, to be honest, than Cash and Evidoma.
I told you they've been listening to our podcast. This is exactly what we said. Yeah. And I do think that, like I said before about Ricarda Bauernfeind, she is so strong, you know, in Flèche Wallonne. Don't want to go back to that race again, but in that race, she was in the break, she was chasing, and yet still she was there, and, you know, really good finish right at the end as well. And so I think if they can utilize Nivea-Doma in a different way to how they have done previously, like they did in this race, I think that can actually work really well in their favour. And they do seem to have changed their racing style a little bit. Perhaps that's the input of Magnus Backstead being more attacking, because I think in the past we'd often seen from Canyon SRAM it was more of a sort of wait and see tactic, and it didn't really work for them. And although, you know, they haven't had those really big wins this year, I don't think that represents the way they've been racing. I think they've been racing very aggressively. They've always been in the moves. They've been potentially unfortunate in the final, and it's not been for want of trying. So I do think that we're kind of on the cusp of something really big there, and that's really exciting. You know, the talent of Bauernfeind coming through, she's going to be one up there in the final of these races in, you know, next year or in the next couple of years. I absolutely believe it.
And what has been so great about watching Liège Best on Liège is seeing all of the other teams taking the race to SD Works. I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, ST Works still, well, they still won and still came third. But it was, you know, exciting because the other teams were taking the race to them. And I know that I was seeing some of the interviews from yesterday, from, you know, the day before the race, with Ashley Moolman, Passio, and Avita Muzik. And they were both saying, you know, the way they were asked the question about how do you beat Vollering, how do you beat SD Works? And they were saying, well, it's going to take all of the teams working together and, you know, working in unity to some extent to beat them. They didn't get beaten, but I guess it's the closest we've been to seeing their strength being dismantled, isn't it, really?
There's actually a WhatsApp group with every team except for SD Works on it.
That's how it's being done.
No, but now we've said that, there will be one for the next race. Yeah, because yeah. we know that the peloton, you know, has direct ears to the podcast and take our tactical advice very literally. it needed to happen for the, you know, for everybody else's sake and also for the fans, because, you know, we came off the back of Ronde van Vlaanderen really quite disheartened, didn't we? We were kind of just like a big old deflated balloon, you know, that balloon that's been hanging around for 3 weeks, sitting in the corner of the living room looking shriveled and a bit upset. And
oh, great, that really bring in the listeners.
But it was one race, and you know, you're allowed to be disappointed by one race, and sometimes it takes some disappointment or something going wrong in order to incite change, doesn't it? And that does seem to have happened. You know, that race was such a disappointment, and I feel like it was a disappointment across the board for all teams. And since then, every single race has been explosive. And I mean, it's almost that every single race has almost still been won by SD Works, but it's still been really good to watch, very exciting. And not true, of course, EF Education, TIBCO, SVB winning Paris-Roubaix, Sylvia Persico winning Brabant-Spile. And so, you know, there's definitely been some step change in the attitude of other teams about how we approach and tackle these races. And despite the fact that the results don't necessarily reflect that, that is 100% what we've seen. So going into this May block where we've got the Vuelta, you know, perhaps we'll see Annemiek sort of come really back to the top in this race, because we've got time trial and stage race, and that's more her sort of domain. And then the May races in Spain, which offer something different and also probably a different change of lineup as well, which is going to be interesting. I think the teams have got a bit more hunger in their bellies now. Liège-Bastogne-Liège will have shown what everybody can do, and the gap to SD Works is small. It's not as big as it looks on paper. I really believe that. It's just about tactically beating them and everybody working together to beat them.
Yeah, that you did a great job of reinflating that sad-looking balloon.
Sad balloon
as
in the corner of the room.
Well, Lizzie, it's not too much longer till we'll be chatting again, actually, because we've got our monthly cycling podcast, Feminin, coming out this week, where we'll be looking back over the whole of the Spring Classic season and dissecting it a little bit further. The winners, i.e. SD Works, and the losers, i.e.
everybody else.
I look forward to chatting to you more then, Lizzie, and I'm sure the listeners will be excited to hear more from you as well.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.